before us today that will be testifying, although I don't want to call it testifying so much as discussing with us. Madam?
The recording didn't start until just now.
All right, that's fine. We rely extensively on our clerk here to keep things running smoothly.
Do you mind starting over?
Yeah, I meant to say that rhyme that you just said, too.
I forgot what I said, it just sort of came out.
Slightly late, but it's worth the wait.
Slightly late, but worth the wait.
Yeah.
Even the governor said, while we were up there, she said, did you want to leave early and get down there? I said, heck no. Being on the third floor with, for a rather momentous occasion was just absolutely worth the time. And I apologize for us being delayed, but I believe we'll get it all in today since we have no events that are following us here. We can go as long as we like. And I'm very happy to see Gavel the Gavel here, because I would like to see this entire presentation on and on and on. So because the amount of information I'm expecting is large, and I so appreciate having experts here, and I've met with almost all of them, one, and found them to be nice guys, too. And see what, you have a high bar to meet, don't you? But you're up first. So actually what I'm going to do is say, you have this one up first? Is that wrong, though? It's expensive. Okay. So, Mr. Hosey.
Thank you.
For the record, of course, your name, your ID, your driver's license number, your wife's maiden name, your all those things.
All of the pertinent details.
But certainly who you work for and who you represent.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Spencer Hosey. I am the founding partner of the San Francisco-based law firm Hosey MacArthur. I have been asked to speak to you today about the duty to develop under the Alaska DL-1 lease form, specifically in oil and gas law generally. But before I turn to the substance of that, I thought it might be helpful if I took a moment or two to review my background to give you a sense of the perspective I bring to bear on this important question. I have been a practicing oil and gas lawyer for close to 25 years. I started in the early 1980s as a young lawyer working for the state of Alaska in what was then known as the Amerada Hess case. Today, we run a national energy and intellectual property practice from our San Francisco office. We represent a wide range of private and public royalty owners. For example, I have been the state of Louisiana's lead outside energy lawyer for close to a decade in both litigation matters and regulatory matters. We have represented the state of Hawaii. We have worked with the Federal Department of Justice in connection with federal royalties in the whistleblower or key TAM context, and have deep experience in oil and gas matters generally. I think it's fair to say over the last two decades and the literally scores of matters we've been involved in that I have personally had the occasion and opportunity to review millions of pages of oil company documents. And so I bring to this question, I think, a fairly deep and detailed understanding of how oil companies assess a capital-intensive upstream infrastructure project. What matters, what doesn't, what gets built, what doesn't, and why. And it's that perspective that I bring to this duty to develop question. With that by way of introduction, Mr. Chairman, let me turn to the substance of the question, the duty to develop. To understand the duty to develop, it is important to understand the nature of the relationship that an oil and gas lease creates between the royalty owner, which is the landowner on the one hand, and the oil company on the other hand, because it is a relationship very unlike a typical commercial arm's length relationship. The process starts with a landowner that has land that may or may not have mineral resources on it. But the landowner typically doesn't have the expertise to explore the property, doesn't know how to develop the property, doesn't know how to produce any hydrocarbons found, and certainly doesn't know how to market hydrocarbons for the best possible price. The landowner needs a partner, and that's, of course, the oil company. The oil company has exactly the suite of expertise that a landowner needs. Oil companies are expert at development, at exploration, at marketing. And so what happens is the two get together and sign a very short contract called a lease. And I mean short. I mean it's a 2 pages, 2.5 to 3 pages long. It's a very short document, given that the relationship created can last 50, 70, 80 years. Now, the landowner contributes the real estate, the land that the landowner owns. That's what the landowner brings to the table. For their part, the oil companies contribute their expertise. They promise to get the lease in the first instance, to use their expertise to explore the property, to develop the property, to produce the hydrocarbons, and to market the hydrocarbons, all for the mutual benefit of both themselves and, importantly, the landowner, the royalty owner. That's how an oil and gas lease works. In return for promising to use its expertise to develop and to market, the oil company typically gets the lion's share of the value of production. And in Alaska, under the largely prevalent DL1 lease form, the oil companies get a full 87.5% of the value of production. The state's royalty share is 12.5%. And that, given modern standards, is very low, but it was the norm back when the state's DL1 lease form was drafted in the late 1950s. But in return for the lion's share of the value, the oil company has the obligation to explore, develop, produce, and market diligently, all with the mutual interests of both oil company and landowner in mind. It's a relationship which the courts have characterized for many, many decades as one of mutual interdependence. The precise phrase the courts use, it's a relationship of mutual benefit. They're in it together. And that means that the oil company, after it signs on the dotted line on the lease, is no longer free to use its unilateral economic self-interest to make decisions. It's no longer free to say what makes us the most money and act accordingly. To the contrary, in making development decisions, production decisions, it has to take into account the interests of its partner in this venture, the royalty owner, the landowner. So it's no longer a commercial relationship where one party acts according to its economic self-interest alone. And that's a critically important thing about the royalty relationship that is really quite unique to that relationship and very much unlike a typical commercial relationship. Now, oftentimes the economic interests of the royalty owner and the oil companies are aligned. But every so often there comes a situation where the interests diverge, where they depart. And one common place where we see a divergence comes with development or further development. And here's why. A landowner almost invariably wants the property developed. A landowner, a royalty owner, only gets paid when the hydrocarbons are produced, severed, and sold. That's the event that generates the royalty payment to the royalty owner. So they want the product developed so they can get paid. And of course, that's why they've gone to the oil company in the first instance, produce this property for us. On the other hand, you can have a situation where a given oil company, for any number of reasons, might prefer not to develop a given property, at least not right now. They might be long in the particular resource, e.g. long in gas on the west coast of the lower 48. They might be short of cash. They might have sufficient cash but prefer to spend those dollars somewhere else on projects abroad where the oil company perceives that if it doesn't move development forward, it will lose the opportunity. The company may have what's known as a very high internal hurdle rate, which is a return on investment rate that must be exceeded to green light a development project. For instance, Exxon's return on investment for its upstream activity in 2005 was 46%. Its ROI across the company in 2006 was 33%. That's a very high return on investment. And so there could well be a situation where a company says, you know what, this might be an economic project, but it's not economic for us because we want all projects to be at 30% plus return before we go forward. Or a company might simply be spending its money in other ways. Another case in point, in the last 2 years, Exxon spent $41 billion buying back its stock on the open market. That's $41 billion in 2 years. And it did that to keep its stock price high and to keep Wall Street happy. And I'm not saying that that's an irrational thing for Exxon to do. From Exxon's perspective alone, that was probably a great idea because its stock price is high and Wall Street is happy. And, you know, those are important goals for Exxon. But the key point is this. Once Exxon was in a lease relationship with the state of Alaska, one going back 30 years, one under which Exxon and the other producers on the North Slope have made gargantuan profits from production to date, Exxon can no longer make decisions based solely on its own economic self-interest. That's not the proper approach. And so there's this inherent conflict in development circumstances. The landowner says, listen, we really want you to develop because that's how we get paid. The oil company says, well, you know, it's really not in our interest, at least not right now. We've got other things we'd prefer to do. That conflict is solved by the implied duty to develop. And the implied duty to develop can be expressed fairly, very simply. It's in plain terms. An oil company has an obligation to go forward with a given development project if that project is, on its own merits, reasonably economic. Full stop, period. That's the duty. If a given project is reasonably economic, the oil company has an obligation to go forward. Why? Because that's the deal it made to get the lease. It said, I will use my expertise to develop this for you diligently. And in return, I want the lion's share of the value of the production. That was the deal going in. And so if a given project is economic, the oil company has an obligation to its partner in this venture, the royalty owner, to go forward. One analogy I have used that I find helpful in this area, it relates to the following. Assume that Toyota is thinking about putting a new manufacturing facility in one of five or six southern states in the lower 48. And so it goes to the five or six states and says, listen, we're ready to spend our development dollars. We're going to build a manufacturing factory. We're going to give jobs. We're going to help your tax base. This is great for you. But tell us, what will you do for us? And that will start essentially an auction between the various states to see which state can put together the most attractive development deal with tax incentive and real estate rebates and job promises and educational benefits and the like. And at the end of the day, let's say that Kentucky wins that contest and Toyota agrees to put the plant in Kentucky. But let's also say that Kentucky does something that's pretty shrewd. It says, as part of the first deal, listen, Toyota, this is all great. This is all well and good. But if this first facility is profitable, and if there comes a time when you're thinking about putting a second factory in, you have to build it in Kentucky. That is exactly the situation the state of Alaska is in with its leases. They made the obligation to develop diligently for the mutual benefit of both the state of Alaska and the oil companies when they signed the leases so many years ago. And under that obligation, they don't get to come to the state now and say, listen, you know, we can get a higher rate of return elsewhere on our money. Or there might be a more profitable project in Kazakhstan or Qatar. Or, yeah, we'd really prefer to spend our money buying our stock back. Tell us, make it worth our while. That is absolutely a breach of the obligation under the lease form, a lease form that these companies have done extremely well by. That's the duty to develop. Now, the question arises, well, all well and good, Mr. Hosey, but is that duty present in Alaska law and the DL-1 lease forms? And I can tell you, yes, unequivocally and absolutely it is. And when was the last time you heard a lawyer say something that absolutely? No, it is absolutely present, and here's why. First, paragraph 19 of the DL-1 lease itself talks about further development and specifically says that the producer, the oil company, has to have due regard and I quote, "due regard for the interests of the state in making additional drilling and development decisions." That's the language of mutual benefit. Second, this question has already been resolved in this state. In what was then known as the ANS royalty litigation in 1989, then judge, now Justice Walter Carpinetti, issued a decision looking at the DL-1 lease form and which duties were in that document and which not. And in that decision, which was fully binding on the parties, the state and the oil companies alike, Judge Carpinetti said that the DL-1 lease form contained a full array of duties, including the implied duty to develop. There simply can be no question but that there is a duty to develop under the Alaska lease form and Alaska law generally. And so the question arises, given that the duty exists here, what constitutes a breach? What can't an oil company do? When would conduct qualify as a breach of the implied duty to develop? Well, if an oil company looks at a particular project, be it the Point Thompson unit or a gas line in Alaska, and if the oil company concludes that that project is on its own terms reasonably economic, but nonetheless refuses to go forward, that is a breach of the implied duty. Full stop, period. If the oil companies refuse to do that economic analysis, but instead refuse to invest because they have an overall national or perhaps international policy of not spending on capital enhancements for the following year or 5 years, that would be a breach because they have to at least run the numbers and check to see if it's economic. If an oil company refuses to go forward, but then if a third party comes and says, listen, we will build it if you'll sell us your production at a reasonable market price, if that happens and the oil company says, nope, we're not going to build it, but you know what, we're not going to sell it to you either, that would be a breach of the implied duty. And why is that? Because effectively they're just bottling the resource up in the ground. The courts call that speculative in-ground warehousing. They're warehousing the resource, and that violates every tenant of the oil and gas lease because it may be in their best interest, but it surely is not in the royalty owner's best interest. And so there are cases going back 40 years that say, listen, if they are in-ground warehousing, that is inappropriate. It's a violation of the lease. You can't just bottle it up. And if they've done that, that's improper.
Interrupt just
Mr.
briefly.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, there are situations where Exxon doesn't have a pipeline to put anything into, and for 20 years they've been recycling the gas. So they have been satisfying their duty. And at what point do you say you're no longer satisfying your duty?
Mr. Chairman, the state, when the state concludes that a gas pipeline is reasonably economic, it has the right to make Exxon and the other producers choose. Either they build it or they let the resource go.
Okay.
And that's the critical point I'm building to, because what's the remedy? Let's assume you have a breach, or you think you have a breach. Let's assume you're stuck. You've got a lot of gas stranded, you want a pipeline, and they're just not building it. You know, negotiations go on for years and years and years. It's this, it's that. But pragmatically, nothing happens. The first shovel hasn't touched the ground once on a gas pipeline. And let's assume you're unhappy about that. So what does the state do? Well, litigation is a bad option. Litigation should never be your first option and is rarely a happy outcome. But fortunately, there is a different remedy for a royalty owner in a breach of the implied duty context, and it's this. If you go to the oil companies and say, listen, is it economic? And if they say it's not and we're not going to go forward, there is a price to them to say that there is a consequence. And the consequence is they have to surrender the resource back. For example, Point Thompson unit. It's been 30 years since the Point Thompson discovery well was drilled. You haven't seen a drop of oil or a foot of cubic gas produced from Point Thompson. It's been 30 years of studies, maybe tomorrow, mañana, mañana, 30 full years. The oil companies have said repeatedly to the state, it's not economic to develop Point Thompson. We won't go forward. We won't go forward with the gas line generally until you, the state, make compromises, compromise your economic position to improve our economics. In my understanding, that's what they've said to the state repeatedly. And I've seen language like that in the Point Thompson plans of development, the annual plans. In that situation, they have said they're not going forward, and they cannot say that yet continue to hold the resource indefinitely. Why not? Because they're just bottling it up in the ground, and they're speculating with the gas and warehousing it until, for their own reasons, they think the time is right. And maybe that's 5 years, maybe it's 10 years, maybe it's 20 years. Maybe it's after they burn through the 900 trillion feet of gas they're producing in Qatar. I don't know when they're willing to do it, but what we do know is they sure aren't willing to do it today. I read an op-ed piece by Representative Dugan a couple weeks ago. He said, you don't have a pipeline because Exxon doesn't want you to have a pipeline. And I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right. So the remedy isn't to charge off in litigation. That's, you know, it's not your job to compel them to honor their obligations and build a pipeline. And honestly, does the state want an unwilling partner in a project like this? No. Just make them choose. If they really don't think it's economic, they have to give the resource back. And then you can go to other oil companies that perhaps have a greater need for gas today as against 10 years from now, or may have a greater need for reserves, e.g. Shell. Shell would love to have a deeper reserve base, e.g. Chevron. Chevron is working hard and spending money all over the world to increase its reserves. Different companies have different positions and different needs. And, the royalty owner has the right to get the resource back if the first set of producers won't move forward on it, and see if you can't get another group of producers to commit to build the project in concrete and specific terms. Now, what do we know about the North Slope and development and the duty? As I said, we know that the producers have said that right now it's not economic to go forward. I mean, that's been, as I understand it, the entire justification to ask the state to give some economic concessions. Help us make it economic. It's not economic without help. Well, two things on that. First, if that's true, they have to give the resource back. And second, I know at least that that's not what Exxon really thinks. And here's how I know. There are detailed accounting standards that govern how an oil and gas company reports reserves for its SEC filing purposes. SEC is the Securities and Exchange Commission, for annual reports and quarterly reports. They're called financial accounting standards, and they're promulgated by the FASB, or Financial Accounting Standards Board. And Financial Accounting Standard 19 governs how an oil company accounts for exploratory drilling costs on properties that are not yet proven and not in production. And that accounting standard changed on April 4th, 2005. And the new standard said the following: oil company, you can continue to capitalize, that is, carry on your books, these expenses, but only if you have no substantial doubt that the project is economically viable, and two, economically viable under today's market prices and with today's technology. Let me say that again because it's important. And I am specifically quoting paragraph 31A of FAS 19-1, promulgated April 4th, 2005. Oil company can continue to expense development costs, continue to capitalize development costs only if it has no substantial doubt that the project is economic and be economic based on today's market prices and technologies. Exxon reviewed that new accounting standard in May and June of 2005, and on July 1st, 2005, reported that it had decided that Point Thompson was not a project with substantial doubt as to its economic viability based on 2005 technology and market prices. There is a one-line footnote in their 10-K for 2005 that says They've adopted the new accounting, and when you look at the new accounting, that's what you see they have to have done. And so this was not a decision made lightly. SEC reporting for oil companies, especially given the Shell debacle of some years ago, is something they take very seriously and are careful about. And so Exxon will have looked at the economics. It will have talked to its outside auditors, PricewaterhouseCoopers, PwC. There will be paper going back and forth, and Exxon would have determined and convinced its auditors, who had to sign off on this, that Point Thompson was not a project with substantial doubt about its economic validity. That is inconsistent with what Exxon was telling the state right there and then. And even this past couple of months, I've read testimony where Exxon officers have said, you know, this project's not economic without help from the state. If they really believed that was true, they could not have taken the SEC accounting they took. They did not, forgive me for being blunt, they did not mislead the SEC. They truly think it's economic. But what they were doing with the state was negotiating. These are people that negotiate for a living. It was a negotiation. It wasn't actually accurate when they said it's not economic. It was just a negotiating position. And so it's really important that the state understand that these are negotiations, and you know, sometimes they're positions and sometimes they're negotiating postures. You know, you have to be careful to take what you're told with a grain of salt. And so, you know, that I thought that was a significant discrepancy between what Exxon was telling the state and what it was telling the SEC, the investing public, and Wall Street. The final point I'd like to make is that it's easy to talk about these oil companies as sort of a shapeless, faceless they, some sort of monolithic they. But they're not that. They are different companies. I mean, Exxon behaves, thinks, and acts one way. Chevron is a very different oil company. It has different needs and desires. And ConocoPhillips is very different, too. And it's very important, I think, for the state to understand that even though these companies are terrifically good at presenting a unified face to the state, internally, they may have sharp disagreements about what's proper and what's not and what should be done. And it's important in dealing with them to keep that in mind. Thank you. That's all I have, but I would be delighted to answer any questions Mr. Chairman or committee members have.
Well, first of all, let me do a little housekeeping. Present are Representative Guttenberg, Representative Edgman, Seaton, Gardner, Wilson, Fuke, Newman. And my co-chair is missing, and Gatto.
Kawasaki just stepped
I'm out. Sorry, and I'm sorry, Representative Kawasaki, who will be back in just a second. And there are some questions, and I think I saw Representative Edgman with the first question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just, I think you might have already touched on this and probably answered it fully, but to return back to the term reasonably economic. And my understanding through your presentation was that term seems to be very well grounded in law, 40 years of case law, if I'm not mistaken, federal law and so forth.
Correct, Representative. And one might ask, what does it mean to be reasonably economic? The first point is that it is not the state's obligation to make this a risk-free proposition for the oil companies. Why? Because they accepted risk when they signed the lease. That's one reason they're getting 87.5% of the value. It's not your obligation to wring all the risk out of the project. Two, what's reasonably profitable? Well, you know, it's a function of investment rates and rates of return seen in the industry generally. Maybe it's 8%, maybe it's 10%, maybe it's as high as 12%, but I'll tell you, it is not 25%. It's not 35%. It's not 40%. And if the oil companies have a gating ROI hurdle that is that high, and if they haven't green-lighted you because you're economic but not screamingly economic, that's a violation of the lease. I mean, the other point I would add here is that all of these companies have written upstream investment guidelines that set forth specifically by region and by hydrocarbon what their investment hurdle rates are. So they will have a hurdle rate that governs Point Thompson. And I think the state is entitled to see these documents if the oil companies are taking the position, as I understand that they are, that the project's not economic. What metrics are they using to measure a reasonable return on investment?
Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hosey, if I understood what you said, you said that the oil companies were posturing because it was really kind of a negotiating type thing, and they're stating their position, and they're going to see what we're going to do, that type of thing. Do you think that when we went through AGEA and the state had its must-haves, and the oil companies said that was impossible for them to do, and so therefore, and I've heard some, I've actually heard some radio commercials saying that they want in, but we're not allowing them in. Now, so the must-haves, is it set up so that they can't get in, or is it they just don't want to be in?
Representative Wilson, what they've said is just another piece of a larger negotiation. You know, that's what you'd expect them to say. They want the deal on the terms most economic for them. That's their job too. I mean, their job is to sharpen their pencils and get the best possible deal that they can. I would not assume that in fact they stay with the position that the must-haves are deal breakers for them, nor would I assume that they ultimately feel or will be excluded. What you have done here, I think, is sparked off an open competitive process, which is a good thing, which is a very good thing. And at the end of the day, if the state says move it or lose it to Exxon and the other producers, you know, commit to building, do it or give it back, I think you will find that they won't give it back.
Representative Buick.
Thank you, Speaker. And I appreciate the good graces of the chairman to allow me to sit here and ask. Mr. Hosey, I would like to know a couple things. One, what is the lease agreement called that the state operates under?
It's called, Representative, it's called the DL-1 lease agreement, DL for Department of Lands 1, because it was the very first lease drafted in 1959 by, ironically, a lawyer who worked for Chevron's law firm.
DL-1.
DL-1.
DL-1. Okay. And the other question I had is, what is the name of the document where that accounting is located that you referred to regarding their statement and their change of position that occurred on April 4, 2005?
The representative, there are several documents that are essential to this. The first is their 2005 10-K or annual report. It has a category in the financial footnotes for suspended well costs, and it specifically calls out Point Thompson by name. And it says that we, Exxon, are not expensing Point Thompson costs. We're continuing to carry them as a capital asset. And then it cites the new accounting standard, financial accounting standard, or FAS 19-1. And so you also need to look at 19-1, and particularly paragraph 31 sub A. Now I sound like a lawyer. 31 sub A. of FAS 19-1, and 31A is the paragraph that says what they have had to have concluded in order to take the accounting treatment they took. And that was a new standard, and under 31A they had to look at Point Thompson and say, we have, and I quote, no substantial doubt, close quote, about the economic viability of Point Thompson. If they had concluded, as they told the state, that it wasn't economic, their accounting treatment was flat out improper. And it's the inconsistency between what they told the SEC and what they were contemporaneously telling the state that I wanted to call to the committee's attention. Final point on that, it's less a new accounting for them, because they were capitalizing all along. What was new was the new accounting standard that made them ask and answer this question specifically in that April, May, June 2005 period. That was new. They looked at it. They said, we have no substantial doubt about economic viability, and they took the requisite accounting benefit thereafter. So again, the 2005 annual K, the 10K, the annual report, FAS 19-1, and particularly paragraph 31A therein.
I could see Exxon talking to the SEC and saying, well, this is profitable. We can make 12%. And coming to the state and saying, this is not profitable. We can't make 33%, 46%, some number. And they're both, I guess they're both accurate.
They are. If they had come to the state and said, you know what, this product, this project is reasonably profitable. We could make 12% return on it. But, you know, we're not going to go forward unless you better our returns because we want to make 35%. I think the negotiation would have been different had they come to you and said that back in 2005, had they conceded that it was economic, but they wanted you to make it more economic. I mean, a 35% return on investment would make a hedge fund jealous. I mean, that is a very big number in this day and age. You know, but that's not what they said, as I understand it. They didn't say that. They said, listen, we'd love to build it, but the economics are just too skinny. Give us help.
Okay. Representative Seaton has a question. I'm going to try to wrap this up in about 5 minutes so we can get the rest of the members who wanted to testify online. So go ahead.
And I'm just curious, have you investigated, you know, do the other owners or other participants in Point Thompson, do they also have those same filings, or is it just the operator of the field?
Representatives, that's a good question. I have checked. BP did the same accounting, took the same accounting in 2005 as did Exxon, although very, very recently, BP wrote down its investment in the Point Thompson unit very recently, probably as a result of the litigation that's now swirling around the unit agreement. ConocoPhillips didn't specifically call it out, probably because the dollars that it has invested weren't large enough to make this a pivotal issue. Exxon is the operator, I think, has the most investment in play there, and so it had to focus on the question specifically.
Thank you, sir.
And use the word specific clarity in the obligation, and specific and clarity, is that taken together, is that enough for a landowner to say, hey, I know what this means, and Exxon to say, hey, I know what this means, and both of them agree?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps not. I mean, if you're dealing with Exxon, Exxon is for the past 10 plus years, Exxon has been famous for high grading, its term, high grading its investment. It wants to drive its ROI up every year, and right now its ROI is twice the average in the oil and gas sector. And so that's a very sound business strategy if you're Exxon, because Wall Street loves it. Your stock price will be strong, your ROI is strong, and you know they can spend the money buying back their stock, and they, you know, that $41 billion they spent buying down their stock, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that money is no longer for upstream development. I mean, you can only spend the dollar once. So Exxon could easily say, you know, I'm sorry, we're just not going to go forward unless we have a project that meets our internal hurdle guideline. And again, they have a specific guideline that governs Alaska, governs Point Thompson, governs the gas line. And, you know, that might be an ROI that's significantly higher than the state feels it should be allowing, especially if, you know, this Exxon's asking the state sweeten the deal by changing tax regimes or making royalty compromises or the like.
Okay. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if this is actually heard in court, the state could, under discovery, request documentation of their internal hurdle, or would there be a better way for us to get that information?
Representative, good question. You certainly have the right to see it in court. Those documents do exist. I know that as a certainty. But you may have subpoena powers. You may, as part of the process of moving this gas pipeline forward, say, listen, show us your economics, show us your hurdle guidelines. You've told us it's not economic. You've asked us to take a haircut. We'd like to trust, but we believe in trust and verification. So show us your paper and see what they say. I mean, I think it would be hard for them to say, we need your help economically, it's not economical, but incidentally, we're not going to show you our own studies. I would put the request in, I'd put it to them that flatly, flat out. You are in this together. They owe you obligations.
Thank you. And who, in your opinion, or do you have an opinion, would be the best person, body, or agency to do that?
I think certainly DNR, and they should go directly to senior Exxon officials and say, we'd like to see the following documents.
You know, I can remember, it was quite a while back because I wasn't in the legislature at all, but reading an annual report, and what caught my eye was just a single sentence, and they were referring to, and I'll quote, our enormously profitable Alaskan operation. And they could have said anything in that report. It was the company's report worldwide, and they singled us out for enormously profitable. And I'm suspicious, at least a little suspicious, that for them, backing off enormously profitable is not a good idea. And as a result, they'll wait until we, our gas is enormously profitable, in which case we're broke, but they're happy.
And Mr. Chairman, I think that's exactly what they're doing. They're waiting you out.
With that, it's been 40 minutes, which was exactly the time allotted. We're right on schedule. I'm going to ask that we take, I really do appreciate your testimony. Certainly was exciting.
Thank you.
We pretty well knew the duty to develop was essentially your topic, and you've really clarified your topic for us with backup information and not just an open statement. I'm going to take just 5 minutes because I need an aide here to put up some things that we had forgotten to do so that it's easier for the next testifiers to know who the heck they're talking to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Ken Meinzinger is going to be up next, but we do have 5 minutes.
Okay, I'm going to move.
Mr. Hosey, if he would supply the 10K reports, and he said he would, we'll get them in electronic format, and I'm very hopeful that we'll have some time to distribute them. Right now, we have, I'm going to call you a friend of mine because we did spend some time together.
Yes, we did.
So, Ken Meinzinger, tell us who you are, who you represent, and enjoy.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ken Meinzinger. I'm with the international law firm of Greenberg Traurig, their Washington, D.C. office. Here to talk to you today about FERC and antitrust issues, specifically how AGEA addresses the competitive problems that would be raised by a producer-owned pipeline. It's a tall task to follow Mr. Hosey, an exciting topic and an exciting speaker, and talk about FERC. I can tell you my wife doesn't find it very interesting, and anyhow, yeah, they don't find it interesting either. But
you do, and that's what counts.
FERC and antitrust issues are critical to understanding AGEA and how it fixes the core problems that would be associated with producer ownership of the pipeline that we all hope to be built. Specifically, and I have a slide presentation, we're not going to put it up on the screen, but it's available in the room here. We're going to address four competitive issues. First, we're going to look at the competitive problems associated with a producer-owned pipeline. Second, we're going to look at how AGEA's must-have provisions work towards fixing those problems. Third, we're going to discuss why those must-have provisions in AGEA are critically necessary to fix those problems. And finally, we're going to briefly discuss a question that has arisen, the question being, well, if an independent pipeline happens to win the AGEA license and holds an open season, what antitrust implications are there, if any, if the producers don't show up to the open season and don't bid for capacity on this pipeline? Before we go into those issues, I'll just tell you a little bit about myself. I've represented several major interstate natural gas pipelines and other clients before the FERC including the largest natural gas pipeline in the United States. I've represented these clients in FERC rate proceedings, certificate proceedings involving the construction of major pipelines, and in some of the largest market power proceedings at FERC in the last several years. I've also served as the chairman of the Antitrust Committee of the Energy Bar Association, and have worked on numerous antitrust matters involving natural gas pipelines and other energy companies, and I think bring a unique FERC and antitrust perspective to this issue. Let's first talk about the competitive problems with a producer-owned pipeline. And I would just say, first, we address these issues in detail in a memorandum that we prepared for LB&A, actually two memoranda, one in 2005 and one, the most recent one, is December 21, 2006. It's posted on the LB&A website if you want to read about this in even more detail. The main competitive issue that we discuss in the memo and wanted to talk about today is one of vertical market power. A producer-owned pipeline would own both the pipeline and the gas. And as a result of that vertical integration would have an incentive not to ship gas produced by competing producers. The analogy I like to use, folks are probably tired of hearing me say it, but is imagine you have three railroads and there's one bridge across the Mississippi River. If one of the competing railroads buys the bridge, whose rail cars is it going to have an incentive to let across that bridge first? It's going to have a clear incentive to let its trains go across and discriminate against its competitors. That's what we're dealing with here. The disincentive that a producer-owned pipeline would have could manifest itself in several ways. First, expansion. As we'll see, it would have a disincentive to expand the line to serve its competing producers. There would be access and discrimination problems. It would have an incentive to find ways, sometimes subtle, to discriminate against its rival producers. It would also have an incentive to delay the project, to not move forward with the project in order to perhaps avoid flooding the market with not only its gas, but gas from its competitors. And finally, the vertical relationship could facilitate collusion between the three producers. And when I use the term producers today, I'm referring to Exxon, BP, and Conoco.
Ken, I didn't realize because I wasn't looking behind me, the computer's not working, and I have plenty of slides here.
Yeah.
I should get Cody to go work on it, or?
Well, whatever your preference is, Mr. Chairman, I'm fine with not having them up on the screen, but.
Let me just take a couple of minutes and we'll see if. On the record.
Okay, thank you. So let's talk about the vertical market power issue just a little more. It's important to recognize that this isn't just theory. This is something that the United States Department of Justice, the Attorney General, in 1977 found to be a major issue. In 77, the Attorney General stated it would be in the interest of producer owners to resist future expansion of this pipeline and discourage future entry into Alaskan gas production by others. Why? Because the producer's market power could be reduced by discovery and development of new fields by other producers in this state. The Attorney General also stated producer-owned pipeline would seek to restrict access and throughput to take monopoly profits. And as a result, in 77, Department of Justice recommended a complete ban on producer ownership of this pipeline. Now, several years later, the Reagan administration revisited the issue. And while they didn't recommend a ban, they issued what is sometimes called a conditional waiver. And essentially what they said was, we might permit producer ownership, but only if the producers can come to FERC and convince FERC that antitrust issues will not be a problem.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. The Department of Justice recommendation of a ban
apply to this pipeline specifically or all such?
It applied to an Alaskan natural gas pipeline to the lower 48 states.
Thank you.
And it's a monopoly pipeline, and so it sets it apart from other pipelines.
It's a very unique situation, as we will discuss.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I have a question here, because I know once they get the pipeline up and going,
right,
usually the first expansion, well, and if they do it by compression, that usually lowers the tariff. So where does that come in? I mean, would they try to work it out so that maybe they themselves even have said that they would just put so much in, but later on we'll try to change that? Or, I mean, does that have any relative significance at all?
Well, there are a variety of ways in which they could try and resist an expansion of a line. First, simply by delaying it. You know, a FERC process takes a long time, and simply the uncertainty associated with what the rates are going to be, when it's going to happen, you know, that can really impact an explorer who's trying to bring its gas online. But we will address that issue specifically in some of the later slides.
Thank you.
I guess the last thing I would say on this slide here is it's important to note that the FERC chairman in 2005, when this issue was raised by one of the members of this legislature, he stated that those antitrust issues are still valid and will be addressed by FERC in any certificate proceeding involving this project. It's also important to note that, you know, precedent both at FERC, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and DOJ since 1977 is consistent with that initial concern expressed by the Attorney General. There are a number of cases at all of these agencies involving vertical market power, a series of FERC orders that seek to address this issue, recognize it's a problem. Similarly, in certain vertical merger cases before the FTC and DOJ. I would also note that the producers cannot really disagree with this point, because at FERC, when they participate in other pipelines proceedings, they frequently complain about the very same issue. And I'd just like to read one quote from one of their filings. This is BP talking. The problem with an affiliate acquiring capacity on its affiliated pipeline is related to the pipeline and its affiliate in the aggregate accruing the ability to exercise market power. It relates to the combined incentive of the affiliate and the pipeline to withhold capacity. In other words, to exercise market power by discriminating against competitors. So this is not really a point that is subject to any reasonable dispute. And I'd also note that we're dealing here with an extreme situation. There is no pipeline in the lower 48 states that even remotely has the sort of vertical market power issues that you would have with this pipeline, where the producers, and such a small number of them, would own the pipeline if that's what ends up happening. And that's contrary to some testimony that I've heard by watching Gavel to Gavel and before, and it was debated last year, and it's just simply incorrect.
I guess it depends on who's testifying.
Yeah, it does. Unlike the 1977 DOJ opinion, AGEA takes a different approach, and let's talk about how AGEA addresses the competitive problems that would be raised by a producer pipeline. AGEA does not advocate a ban. AGEA takes a middle ground approach, similar to the Reagan waiver, in that AGEA invites applications by all parties, including both producers and independent pipelines. So to answer your question, Representative Wilson, AGEA absolutely asks the producers to submit an application and includes them in this process. But instead, what AGEA does, it attempts to fix the competitive problems that would arise if you had a producer-owned pipeline and simply didn't have these must-have provisions that are in AGEA. Let's go through those provisions briefly. Problem one, as we've discussed, there would be an incentive by the producers not to expand the line to serve their competitors. AGEA directly addresses that. It requires that the applicant commit to expand this line in reasonable engineering increments and on commercially reasonable terms that encourage exploration and development of natural gas in this state. So AGEA directly speaks to the perhaps prime issue, competitive problem with a producer-owned line. Note here that contrary to what some prior testimony has asserted, natural gas pipelines are not common carriers. They are not. They are contract carriers, and it's an important difference. Common carriers must, like oil pipelines, at least in theory, must serve all comers. And if there's more demand than capacity, they serve all on a pro rata basis. Everyone gets a piece of the pipeline. Gas pipelines, however, are contract carriers. And what that means is if new shippers come along and want an expansion, the only way they can get capacity is by expanding the pipeline or by obtaining capacity that the existing shippers perhaps don't want and want to relinquish. If with a producer-owned pipeline, the producers would have control over both of those avenues of obtaining capacity. They could try and resist expansion, and they certainly would be under no obligation to release their capacity to their competitors. Also on the expansion issue, AGEA, another one of its must-haves, states that the AGEA pipeline must hold open seasons for expansion capacity every 2 years to determine whether there is interest in expanding the line. Again, AGEA directly speaks to the expansion issue. Another problem related to the expansion issue. Suppose a producer pipeline says, okay, we'll expand, but they'll do it only on terms that are onerous. One of the key ways that AGEA addresses that is through the rolled-in rate requirement. And here we're assuming a situation where the expansion would cause rates to increase. Were you to have incremental rates, that would cause the explorers to pay significantly higher rates in many cases than the existing shippers. They'd be at a severe competitive disadvantage. AGEA again tries to strike a middle ground there by requiring rolled-in rate treatment of expansion costs up to 15% increase in the existing rates, trying to reduce again the barriers to entry, if you will, faced by competitors. These rolled-in rates are consistent with the FERC policy in Order 2005 and with the federal law, ANCPA, that mandates that FERC use rate criteria which promote exploration, development, and production of Alaska's gas. Another problem, as we mentioned, is discrimination in access. In this case, a producer-owned pipeline really is indifferent to having high transportation rates for the pipeline. Why? Because they're just